Well, I'm Jerry Twombly, and I'm the president of a company called Development Marketing Associates, DMA. And we work with Christian ministries all over the world in areas relating to development, fundraising, and public relations, and strategic planning, and all the kinds of things that, you know, organizations need to address if they're going to be able to sustain their impact, you know, over time. And, you know, so often in the cases of the organizations that we represent, you know, it's kind of a, you know, strategic planning, and the kinds of issues that we're talking about tend to be more oriented towards a fiscal year planning. You know, we just want to survive until next year, and so survival becomes a real important part of life, and we're hoping that we can be used of the Lord to help organizations really establish themselves so that they can have the long-term impact that you know, we long for them to have, because we want to be around until the Lord comes back and doing those neat things that God gives us to do. You should have a set of notes in your book if you signed up for this training or this particular seminar. And if you don't have a set, we have some extras up here. Okay. So we've got, why don't you just take one of those and anybody else that needs one. And Yeah, okay. There we go. Why don't we begin and ask the Lord's blessing upon our time together, and then we'll kind of get into the material here for the day. Father in heaven, thank you for your goodness to us. Thanks for the privilege of being here at the forum and for the work that you do here that has such incredible impact, not just on the people who come and listen and respond, but to those that we will go back to and hopefully have even a more effective ministry as we seek to really serve you and the places where you've granted us that opportunity. We're so grateful for the new friends that we make here. We're grateful for the reminder that events like this create, and that is the understanding of the uniqueness and the dimensions and the breadth and the depth of the body of Christ. We thank you for the privilege you've granted us to serve you and to live for you and to love you and to experience from you the abundance of life that you've promised. Guide us in our discussions in this hour. We pray that they might be profitable and practical and applicable to the ministries in which we're involved. And to that end, we give you thanks and praise, for we pray in your name. Amen. Let me give you a little bit of a broad introduction to, you know, to development. Some of you have been in seminars that I've taught. Others of you are hearing me for the first time. And so the concepts of development, especially as they relate to creating a developmental calendar, are important to understand, kind of the underlying concepts of development. DMA and the organization that I represent has basically been recognized in various places around the world as kind of a leader in developing concepts of what we call relational development. It's our belief that if you're going to have an effective ministry, not just in terms of development, I mean, raising money and all those kinds of things that we're all obviously concerned about, but if we're going to have a ministry that's going to have enduring impact, then it's going to be predicated to a significant degree upon how effective we are in building relationships. But development's all about relationships. It really has very little to do with money. It has very little to do with what you have to say, interestingly enough. And, you know, I speak at a lot of pastors' conferences and activities, you know, with various organizations around the world throughout the year, and I love to make that statement, not because, perhaps because of the fact that it causes us to kind of, you know, become a little bit alert, because what it is we have to say is obviously very important. The message that we have is incredibly relevant, you know, to the needs of men and women and boys and girls in the world in which we live. But the realities are, the effectiveness of what it is we have to say is only enhanced by our ability to build relationships. That to the degree that we build relationships, we tend not to lack for money. We tend not to lack for an audience that will hear us and essentially respond to what it is that we have to say. But to the degree that we lead with our need, you know, whether that need be for money or that need be to be heard, then the realities are we're often perceived as being manipulative. People look at us as kind of thinking, well, I know what they're after, and when they fail to respond in ways that are consistent with our need or the way we approach them, then oftentimes you never see those people again. And so the real passion of mine is to help organizations to put in place programs and the things that they can do to facilitate relationship building, to put those in place so that we can be even more effective in what it is that God's called us to do. I'm known within my country as being fairly successful in areas relating to fundraising, which always kind of bothers me a little bit because I hate to be introduced as a fundraiser. I always notice the responses of people when, you know, this is Jerry Twombly and he's a fundraiser, and people start backing off a little bit, you know. And then they start reaching for their wallet, or at least they want to know where it's at, or their purse. They're kind of covering it over because they don't want to be fleeced of something that they feel they're not prepared to give. And but our ministry has been successful in helping organizations raise, by at least some calculations, close to $2 billion to help further the cause of Christ. But my real passion is not fundraising. It's really helping organizations to become better at what it is that they do. And interestingly enough, to the degree that they're better at what it is that they do, they don't tend to lack for funds. And it's really kind of an interesting phenomena. But, you know, so often the need for funds has become so pervasive, you know, that it focuses on everything that we need to do, and consequently we lose a little bit of the joy of what it is that God's called us to do in the first place, and that's to fulfill a very unique and distinctive mission. And so that's kind of a little bit of background. I want to talk to you a little bit today about, you know, creating a developmental calendar. And what really is involved in creating a calendar. You know, calendars are really kind of interesting. If you look at somebody's calendar, you can really tell a lot about them. I enjoyed actually doing that, is asking somebody to look at their calendar and looking at organizational calendars, because, you know, it does reflect a little bit of the organization and what they perceive as important, because we tend to schedule those things that are meet particular needs that we have. If you look at a person's individual calendar, you learn a lot about them. You know, if they've got, you know, a party every Friday night, then you probably could conclude that they're, you know, in need of something, that basically that particular aspect of their scheduling reflects. If they're going to a lot of seminars, or if they're, you know, doing any number of other things, it does tell you something about what's important to them and some of the needs that they represent. When we plan an institutional calendar, it seems to me that it revolves around two broad areas of importance to us as organizations. You know, one of them is our mission. The calendar events that we schedule basically should provide us opportunities to be able to share with other organizations, or to with other individuals, those who participate, the nature of what it is that we're really all about as an organization. You know, mission statements, and I want to talk to you a little bit about mission statements, that mission statements, you know, are pretty basic to development. You know, development really revolves around your mission. Relationships, we define development actually in our ministry. We define development as the things that we do to build rational relationships with others. That really what development is all about, the things that you do organizationally to build the kind of infrastructure to support your enduring ministry. You know, are based upon people's commitment and understanding of your mission. I always tell people that if development represents the things that we do to build rational relationships with others, then the rational aspect of that is really embodied in your mission statement. You know, that's the thing that you can really get your arm around. That's the objective aspects of who it is we are. When people ask you who it is you are, you say, well, this is our mission. And in essence, when you state your mission, you are essentially, you know, stating, you know, the very reason for your existence. One of the organizations, and mission statements, let me just say that mission statements are unique from the standpoint that they're typically a series of clauses that are separated by commas. And each one of those clauses, you know, communicates one aspect of who it is that we are. You know, a church's mission statement will typically have clauses that would indicate their understanding of the responsibility of that particular congregation to fulfill biblical mandates like training and equipping people for work of ministry, evangelization, Judea and Jerusalem, Judea and Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth. So what it is we're doing locally as well as internationally or in the world, you know, to address that particular need. And the, you know, the salt and light components of what it is that we're supposed to be doing as believers, being deployed out into the world as salt and light, and the way that that impacts culture and everything that it touches. So most church mission statements will will communicate core principles and then how uniquely they are essentially accomplished through the nature of that particular congregation. It may be a real family-related ministry and so forth, and so that's reflected in their mission statement. Virtually, I'm going to be talking on Wednesday, which is actually one of my favorite things to do in our network. I'm going to be talking about strategic planning and the role that planning has, and especially the areas of mission that need to be planned, because it seems to me that mission statements oftentimes are things that we create because we must have them for any number of reasons. In our country, you can't incorporate as an organization unless you have a mission statement. So, you know, we tend to kind of look around to find a good mission statement that we like. We talk to people, we talk to other organizations of like-mindedness, and we say, well, what is your mission statement? We try to incorporate thoughts necessarily, or perhaps that are, you know, they've developed, and just saves us a little time, but we don't own it. In other words, we create it, you know, because we need to. And so oftentimes mission statements are created for two purposes: one, for incorporation, and oftentimes for accreditation. You know, if you're an organization that is accredited by outside agencies, they're going to ask to see your mission statement as well. And so if you're a part of the EFES movement, then it's likely that, you know, if they're evaluating your organization, they're going to evaluate you against the mission statement and how well you're fulfilling what it is you've committed yourself to do.
Can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Because just in our country, it's always kind of, people would ask what's the difference between mission statement and vision statement, and people kind of get lost in that.
Well, the question, I'm just going to repeat the question for the sake of those for the tape, but the question, you know, essentially is, what is the difference between a mission statement and a vision statement? And that's a great question, because I think there is a distinct difference. Mm-hmm. I would define vision as mission accomplished. In other words, vision equals mission accomplished. What would your ministry look like if you were 100% successful in accomplishing it? And so, and sometimes the answer to that question might be, the question might be rephrased. For instance, your medical society or whatever. You know, what would somebody who has participated in your ministry for the last 10 years, how would they be different 10 years from now than they are right now if you were totally successful in fulfilling your mission? Well, it really adds a dimension to the whole mission concept, because we realize that mission impacts a lot of things. It impacts how we think about things. It impacts, you know, the roles that we play and how we act in terms of living our life in light of the mission that has been basically inculcated into our hearts and lives because of what it is that we've done.
If I, for instance, our organization has developed a mission statement, and over the 6 months or 1 year later, we want to change the mission. Have the mission changed over the time, or it's just one for the whole life?
Well, you know, the question is, you know, do you change mission statements, and you know, what would be the motivation to do that? Do they last for life or not? And you know, quite frankly, when I go and visit an organization, one of the things that I used to ask them to see their mission statement, but I don't even do that anymore. I basically ask them this question, the same question that I was talking about before. You know, if you were totally successful in fulfilling, you know, your objectives and your desires for, you know, people to whom you minister, what would they look like when it's all over? You know, I think that's a great question to ask pastors. I love asking pastors that question. If you were totally 100% successful in ministering to congregants over, you know, the next 10 years, what would they look like 10 years from now? And so they begin talking about that. We start to, you know, kind of capture the ideas. And then eventually we put it into kind of a vision statement. And then what I'll do is I say, well, let's take a look at your mission statement. We'll lay the vision statement alongside the mission statement. And sometimes they just don't even match up at all, because the things that we really are committed to doing aren't necessarily reflected in the mission statement. And in those instances, I would suggest that you rewrite your mission statement to really honestly reflect what it is that you're really all about. And I think that's oftentimes the result of the fact that mission statements are something that we inherit that we don't own. You know, they were created by someone else, and so sometimes you just have to constantly either revisit it, or you need to perhaps rewrite it if it doesn't, in fact, reflect, you know, the nature of the ministry in which you're engaged in. And I think, you know, sometimes new ministries, that is oftentimes typical of new ministries, because we start out with one intention, then all of a sudden we realize that when we come into the marketplace, you know, the marketplace is demanding something different than what it is that we thought was a need that we were seeking to address. And so we have to adjust ourselves to accommodate the actual needs rather than what we perceive the needs to be at the time that we began. So I think revisiting them is really important. Certainly reevaluating them is important, or annually evaluating them. Let me just say real quickly, and you want everybody on board with your mission statement. And this is getting a little bit away from the calendar thing, so let's just kind of touch this quickly, although I think it's a very, very important point. At Grace College and Theological Seminary, I served there for 13 years in the development department. And Grace Seminary had a wonderful practice. I always thought this was one of the greatest things that they did at Grace every year. Every year we'd get together, you know, before school began, to have kind of the preschool pep rally. Yeah, you do it in your organizations in different ways, perhaps. But you know, before the students come to the campus, you know, you bring your staff and your volunteer together, and you begin to, you know, just kind of dream about what it is that you're trusting God to do in that particular year. But what our president would do is he'd call, first of all of us who were vice presidents, the administrative team, together, and he'd call us together into his office one at a time, and he'd talk about the mission statement. It was actually a piece of paper, and it had the mission statement written on the top of it, and he'd kind of explain it to us. Then there was a section below that was left blank, and essentially it said, what are you going to do practically this year in your area of responsibility to contribute to the fulfillment of this mission statement? And he was really looking for quantification. In other words, what specifically are you going to be doing this year? How are you going to contribute to this mission statement's fulfillment? And he wouldn't ask us to fill it out right there. He'd say, now I want you to take this back to your office. I want you to sit down and think about it and pray about it and really ask the Lord, you know, for some real insight in terms of what it is that you could be doing this year to help us get this done. And eventually, you know, we were asked to come back to his office where we were to present that to him. Well, he'd look at it, and if it wasn't quantifiable enough, you know, like, I want everybody to feel good about the organization. So that pod might say that as a public relations kind of guy. You know, well, that's not good enough. You know, that's not specific. You know, how do you know if you succeeded that? That's not quite quantifiable enough. He said, well, just go back and work on that. And so, you know, eventually it would come back and to a point where he'd say, okay, I can sign off on that, and he'd sign it, and then I'd sign it. Well, then there was another meeting, you know, during the school year where we'd bring all the faculty and all the staff members and all the people that are involved in our ministry together, you know, custodial people and everyone, and they'd be given the same sheet of paper. And, you know, the mission statement, he'd kind of define it and what it is that we're all about. And then he said, now I want you to go. We're going to have some time today where you can get off by yourself, but I want you to answer this question, no matter what your position is, whether you're a secretary or a volunteer or, you know, a coach, whatever. I want to know exactly how you're specifically going to contribute to the fulfillment of this mission. And what we want you to do is we want you to go to the person to whom you're responsible to. So in my case, it was, I had like 12 people or 15 people that were responsible to me. And so I'd do the same thing the president did. I'd, you know, I'd keep sending it back and sending it back until it was right, and then I'd sign it and they'd sign it. And there was a regular, actually a little service that people would come to where we'd kind of fold it up and we'd kind of present it before the Lord and say, this is what it is we're going to do. Well, we would take these same sheets and we put them into the employee folder. And then we'd have annual performance reviews. And, you know, I always hated, maybe you have annual performance reviews, you know, I never really liked them all that much because I was finding I was being evaluated on things that I didn't even know I was responsible for, you know. And I'd be evaluated on some real subjective things like, you know, you wore the wrong color tie at the annual banquet or something. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't know it was, you know, my tie was something that I was going to be evaluated on. But what we would do is we'd take out that form. And you know, I'd pass it back to you, and we'd sit here and say, well, how are we doing in this area and so forth? So it really kept us focused. Now, I think it's really a challenge to all of us is to keep the mission of our organization clearly in front of people, the people that we're working with, the people that we need to kind of carry the torch for us, that they really know what it is that we're doing, and that collectively we have unique individual responsibilities to try to accomplish that in the lives of those people to whom we minister. Now, we've already indicated that you know, a good way to kind of think about this, especially in terms of scheduling and calendarizing events, is to look at your mission statement in terms of its independent clauses. Habitat for Humanity is an organization with whom we work, the international organization, and we do a lot of training for Habitat affiliates around the world. They have a unique mission statement. I'm just going to share it because it's one of the few mission statements that I know by heart, simply because I talk to a lot of Habitat affiliates over the course of a year. But their mission statement reads like this, that Habitat for Humanity works with God and people everywhere from every walk of life, comma, to build and renovate homes, comma, to create community, comma, so that people can become all that God intended for them to be, period. So it has four primary clauses. They work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life. So it's kind of an ecumenical, you know, Christian ministry. And it displays itself, interestingly enough, in the composition of the board. If you go to the, if it's really being totally 100% fulfilled, which if you go to a building site where they're building a Habitat home, you'll find all kinds of people, from former presidents of the United States to, you know, a factory worker, you know, various ethnic backgrounds and so forth, you'll see represented on the building site. And that's what they really would prefer to see. They build and renovate homes. Most of us would recognize that about Habitat for Humanity, but they also have a real strong commitment to community because they realize that it's in the context of community that we flourish, that God designed us for community. He didn't create us whole. I think that's a very important point to make periodically, is that, you know, God created us discernibly deficient. He didn't give every individual every gift. And it's because we lack, you know, giftedness in certain areas that we're drawn to other people because, you know, Momir has something that can really enhance my ability to be able to do what it is I want to do, and as well as all of you, and collectively we can do things together that we can't do alone. And so they really believe that if a person is going to become all that God intended for them to be, they need to create a community environment. And then, you know, the design, obviously, or the purpose is that this process would lead to people really fulfilling their potential in life that may be thwarted by virtue of the fact that they don't have, you know, decent housing to live in. And so that's their mission statement. And that really kind of drives things. But it seems to me that as we think about creating a calendar, you know, there's some exercises that we're not going to necessarily do now. But let's just take a Habitat example, since that one I've provided. Take each of the question that I provide here is take each of the individual components and determine what would need to happen in order for this to be accomplished in the lives to whom you minister. You know, jot down some of your thoughts in the space that we've provided here below. Let's just suggest that, you know, the whole concept of community. You know, let's assume that we're all Habitat people and we want to communicate that aspect of what it is that we do to a constituents, because we realize that if the developmental process is intended to build rational relationships with people, then they need to rationally understand that this is a part of who it is that we are and what it is that we do. So what could we do? How could we, as an organization, now we're assuming that we're all Habitat people now, just for the sake of illustration, but how could we as an organization communicate this important part of who it is we are? What would be some of the things we could do this year? Pod, you know, I'm not going to let you get by. You're dozing there, man. And so everybody that's listening to this tape will know that he really wasn't dozing, folks. I mean, as a public relations guy, you know, how could you communicate concepts of community to constituents of Habitat for Humanity in this particular example?
Bringing them into a community of, like, starting a relationship with them, is that what you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, community, it could be defined any way that you choose to define community. But if community is a part of your mission statement, it's something that needs to be communicated to your constituents. So how could we effectively communicate it in ways that are going to be memorable to people that are part of the ministry?
Encouraging them to be involved in the ministry. ministry themselves, maybe.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things that we might want to do is to really orchestrate, you know, a strong effort to try to get people to a building site, you know, during a habitat build, because they're going to experience community there. And it really is kind of an interesting experience. If you've never been to, in America, they do what they call blitz builds, and essentially they'll build an entire community, maybe 30 houses in a period of about 2 or 3 weeks, and it is really quite amazing, because I mean here you have people putting up boards, you know, siding on a house, and you've got another group right in back of them painting it. You know, it's just really quite amazing how quickly they do it, and it's really exceptionally well organized. But you really do see people working together. You see older people, you see young people, you see college kids, you see senior citizens, you see bankers, you see politicians, and they're all out there doing it together. And somehow all the artificial facades that are created in life, you know, are all gone. You know, I mean, because here you have people working together. So that would be one way to do it. Can you think of other ways that you could do it? Communicate community.
Nice to hear some stories about communities which have been established.
I think that's a wonderful example, Chris, because I think, you know, anecdotes are powerful communicators. You know, when you anecdotally tell the stories of people that have been impacted in a variety of ways in conjunction with community, because they experience community, and telling those stories can be very, very important to people. So using stories and newsletters, using stories and letters, always remember that anecdotes are probably one of the most powerful ways of communication. And so using those kind of anecdotal stories and telling them when you preach or when you present your organization. See, you could tell me about your medical ministry, but let me tell you about, you know, Dr. So-and-so, who was faced with this particular crisis, and he didn't know really quite how to deal with it and so forth. And so, you know, he had just been to one of our meetings, and now you're telling the story. Now it really takes on some practicality, because hearing about your story just from a descriptive standpoint outside of that context really doesn't have the same kind of impact. Other things that come to mind on how we could...
I think you need to explain to supporters how they fit in to your organisation. Do you know what I mean? How they can be involved with it, but not necessarily give time, but just how they fit in. So, like, for us, we would probably be targeting people who have got links with students, so perhaps, like, got children or grandchildren at university, because that's a really good way of getting them in there.
And essentially, what we're trying to do developmentally is to create community, aren't we? We're trying to engage people who are looking for opportunities to really become involved. I'm convinced of this. We were talking a little bit about this yesterday in the group that we were part of and in the pre-form. But I really believe that people are looking for something that they can plug into, in which they can feel the same sense of fulfillment that we find in our ministries. You know, we oftentimes think, well, you know, there's just not enough people out there to support us in the ways that we need support. But I'm convinced that there are people that are looking for that. Unfortunately, what we typically do is we say, if you want to be a part of our ministry, then give us some money. And so, you know, and if you can't give us money, basically what we're communicating by default is that, you know, there's not a place for you here. You know, there's probably someplace else that you could... you know, participate. But what we really need is we need people who will pray for us. We need people who will volunteer with us. We need people who can perhaps serve as hosts and hostesses at some of our ministry events. There's all kinds of ways in which people can plug in theoretically into what it is that we're doing, and really thinking through that, because what we're doing through that is we're creating community. Because it's in the context of community that I think real effective ministry occurs. I think that's exactly what Paul was at least alluding to in 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 7 when he says, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellency of the power must come from God, because it can't come from us. You know, that none of us singularly, I think, are capable of really doing something really significant for God, that it's in the context of community and the various ways in which we experience it, the various ways in which we live it, the various ways in which we practice it, and how we deliver what it is that we do, that really determines our effectiveness. And so in the end, it's not us that get the glory, it's God that gets the glory, because that's the way he's designed it to happen in the first place. Well, The next thing, and we probably answered both questions here, two and three, in the same exercise. But you know, what are some of the things that you could do? And what I mean by that, what could you actually schedule? You know, what could you put into a calendar, you know, that would enhance the likelihood of these things that we're talking about being accomplished? And so it might be that you put in the calendar that you're going to have a campus, you know, visit, you know, if you're a campus ministry. You put in the calendar that you're going to send some of your doctors and some of the participants in your organization to small groups that may be involved in churches or congregations, and for the purpose of being able to anecdotally share, you know, the issues that we're dealing with in the medical community right now and how we're seeking to address them through our ministry. And you know, there may be any number of things. We do the schedule for the newsletter. You know, Pod's kind of sitting down looking at the year. And this is when and this is really the whole point of, I think, this particular presentation, is that, you know, we need to do a little bit more planning in creating a calendar, not just for, you know, what we're going to do today or tomorrow, but what we're going to do this year. And it may be that you sit down and you look at you've got six issues of this particular piece and two things that you're going to be doing here and five brochures and materials that you're going to produce and so forth on the organization. And so you look back and you say, well, these are the things that we really want to communicate about us and who it is we are and what it is that we're all about. And so you may say, well, you know, students, you know, in terms of our mission, there are four aspects of student life, you know, that are unique to our organization. So I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask you to take on the responsibility of writing an article. Let's assume that you have journalistic skills and whatever. And I'm going to ask you to write an article about a student who's been impacted in this way. And, you know, we'll try to get a photographer assigned to you so that you can get some pictures taken. And we're going to do kind of a photojournalist layout that's going to be in the newsletter. And we're going to say, this is what it is that we do. And we're going to continue to emphasize that throughout the article. In other words, this is what it is we do, this is how it is we do it, and here's somebody that's been impacted by it. And then we have the whole mission statement, and maybe we have the mission statement written out, and that particular aspect of the mission statement that we are talking about in that particular issue is highlighted in a unique way. So at the end of a year, let's assume that we did six issues and there were six aspects of our mission statement, six clauses, that at the end of the year, everybody's going to say, well, gee, yeah, I remember that. Oh, that's what they do because I remember that story and so forth. So we put it into our calendar. You know, so there may be events, there may be activities, and we'll talk about those kinds of things a little bit later on. Now, the other area that calendars ought to reflect, not only our mission issues, and I think, you know, that's very important. Mission is very, very important because there are typically, and let me, I'm digressing a moment, and this isn't in your notes. This is kind of the bonus material that you get when you attend a Twombly seminar, because I don't, you know, notes are kind of a necessary nuisance to me because there's always an idea or two that I want to kind of elaborate on. But there are three reasons why people will choose to sustain their support of your ministry. There are three very, very important reasons that you need to be aware of. Number one is that they know your mission. So people need to know your mission. And those people that know your mission, you know, will, you know, or may choose, in fact, to support you. So, you know, communicating your mission is very, very important. And there's all kinds of creative ways that you could do that. It might be that Pod says, you know, every one of our, you know, staff people at UCCF this year is going to have a business card. And on the business card, we're going to put the mission statement. And this year, we're going to change our stationery around because, you know, we want on our stationery the mission statement of the ministry. We want people to know about it. And we're going to do articles in the newsletter, and we're going to do brochures that talk about the mission statement and so forth. And so he's got this idea plan. That's really important to know and really important to do. A second reason why people will sustain their support of your organization is because, number two, they really believe in that mission. In other words, it's not just something that they know about, but they believe in it. And part of it, you can almost enhance belief by creating statistical studies that basically validate the reasons why you exist. You can talk, and all of us can do that with the ministries that we represent. Why do we have a student ministry? Because 87% of all students that leave, you know, higher educational institutions, you know, walk out without a worldview, or, you know, I mean, you have those statistics that essentially would or they have a worldview, but they just don't know what it is, and they don't know why it's so very, very important. But you know, people that have, you know, that might be interested in supporting your organizations understand that that is very, very important. And so, you know, it's a continuation of just trying to communicate information that would cause people to understand why what it is we're doing is so very, very important, and they come to that commitment or to that belief. One of the things that we have recommended to our clients a lot around the world, actually, is to use the power of email or the internet, which in this particular example is, we have a lot of our clients that use email newsletters. You know, they call them VIP newsletters, things like that. And basically, if somebody requests it, and it's one of the options that we typically would recommend that you request or present to people, is that, you know, we have a VIP newsletter, you know. And VIP, very important person. And if you have an interest in our ministry, you are a very important person. And about every, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, it's not necessarily on a time schedule. You may do them more frequently depending upon, you know, information that may be floating around that you think is relevant to make a connection, you know, so that people are reading a headline, you know, in the newspaper, and then all of a sudden you say, well, there's really a connecting point there, a connectivity point, so let's talk about that. And that would certainly be true in the medical arena where things are happening and people aren't making the connections. You know, they read an article, but they're not making a connection to its relevance in relationship to what it is that you're doing. So you send out a little VIP, you know, email newsletter that says, didn't know if you read this. Something that could be, you know, essentially digested in about 20 seconds or a minute or so. I mean, it's not something that's going to be long and detailed, but something that just little blurbs, you know, to just keep people in the loop in terms of what it is that you're doing. So because it's very important that they not only know your mission, but they believe in it. You know, this is important. If it wasn't for UCCF, if it wasn't for the Medical Association, if it wasn't for the church and the ministries that you're doing, then these things aren't going to happen. So, boy, this is really great that they're doing this. And then the third reason why they'll support you, sustain their support of you, is because they have confidence in your ability to do what it is that you say you're going to do. So that's why the anecdotes are so important, because it builds confidence. Not only are they saying it, but they're doing something about it. And that's something that needs to be communicated. I mean, newsletters and the things that we do, we send out to people, typically have very, very little developmental value. I'll repeat that because it's a good point, despite the fact that most of you didn't catch its significance. But the reality is that newsletters, by and large, have very little developmental value. And what I mean by that is that, you know, sometimes they just, you know, pass on a lot of information and you know, not that it's unimportant information, but it's not taking anybody anywhere. The way that I often validate that point is by making a statement to the effect is, have you ever been around an organization within, say a week before the deadline for the next newsletter? Because people become very, very interesting during that time. They get down on their knees and they do really, you know, incredible things to make sure that they have enough copy to fill the space. And that shouldn't be the case. That essentially, Pod's thought it all out. He knows exactly what's going to be in every newsletter UCCF is going to send out this next year. He's got it all planned. And it all has purpose. And it all has focus. And it all has design intended to accomplish particular objectives. To not only tell the story of mission, but to validate our existence by virtue of the things that are happening. And talking and reporting about the things that have occurred as a result of the existence of our ministry so that people can develop that level of confidence that this is a ministry that's worthwhile because they're doing the job. Okay? Now, there are developmental needs. And so let's flip over to page 2 here. And these are, you know, kind of... they may appear to be a bit mundane, but let me just tell you that there's a term that we use in development, and this is kind of getting into stuff. If you haven't attended some of these other seminars, some of this is going to hopefully not be irrelevant to you, but it's outside the context of the larger context of development. Perhaps it's not going to have on the same significance to you as maybe to someone sitting next to you. I don't know. But there are 6 what we call leading developmental indicators. And these leading developmental indicators are kind of like leading economic indicators. You know, if you're getting ready to invest, you know, in something, you may look at, indicators that would help you to assess objectively the strength of the economy or the strength of what it is that you're contemplating investing in. And so on the basis of that, you're going to make decisions, and you may make decisions not to, you may make decisions to invest, you may make decisions to invest in certain instruments as opposed to other instruments or whatever the case might be on the basis of how you interpret the data. Well, just like there are leading economic indicators, there are leading what I call developmental indicators. And here they are. There's six of them. The size of your database. Now, just kind of keep this in the back of your mind because it does have relevance to what we do in terms of scheduling activities throughout the year. The size of our database, the amount of money that we raise annually, the number of donors that we engage annually, how many people gave to you that didn't give to you, or how many people gave to you this year, the number of major donors, that would be larger donors, and we would define a major donor in terms of the size contribution, and usually it's between $1,000 or above. The number of mega donors, that would be the number of donors who give, say, $10,000 or more. I mean, larger contributions. I'm using U.S. currency, and you can make the adjustments, I'm sure, for your own currencies. And then the last one would be the number of what we call core donors, and that's people who give smaller gifts, say, from $1 or whatever your currency might be, a euro or whatever, to, let's say, where the breakoff point is for major donor. So you want people at those levels. And so just keep that in the back of your mind because it becomes a very relevant point. And so it's something that you need to be aware of, and I think you'll see that in just a few minutes, actually. Development has what I call arms and legs. Development is a concept. You know, I'm typically introduced as a speaker on the areas of institutional development. And so, what does that mean? You know, well, people have their perceptions of what in terms it means. But development, you know, the work of development is accomplished through four primary mediums. And so let's list those mediums, and then we'll give you some examples of each. Projects. There are things called developmental projects. And projects, the thing that distinguishes a project from everything else is listed there, and you might want to circle it in your notes. It's the things that we do that appeal to someone's emotions. Emotions, the definition that we give of development is it's the things that we do to build rational relationships with others. Now, I've already shared that definition to you. But the word rational is a very important word, and I think it has an opposite, an antonym, if you please. And the opposite of rational is emotional. In other words, relationships take on a process. There's a relationship or relational process that actually begins with emotion, and as it develops, it takes on a more rational. The emotion is still there, but it takes on a more rational element. I think a great analogy of development is falling in love. And so if you can think about falling in love, you are initially drawn emotionally to someone. And then you started dating. And you learn more about them. You know, you began to understand about their family and about their interests and about their concerns and so forth. And, you know, you maybe eventually marry. And the emotion doesn't go away. The emotion doesn't go away. But it's stabilized by rationalism. My mother and dad, you know, have been married or had been married. My mom just went to be with the Lord this year, this spring. And she died like just 6 days before their 70th wedding anniversary. If you were to see my mother and dad together, they were incredibly fascinating to watch because they deeply loved one another. And yet they had gone through so much together, you know, in 70 years. The last 10 years of my life, or of her life, my mom had Alzheimer's disease and didn't really even know my father. And yet he faithfully went to her and cared for her and loved her and did all those wonderful things that will always be, you know, embedded in my memory. But yet when they were together, you know, he would hold her. You could just see the emotion there. But, you know, they were married for 70 years, for crying out loud. They'd been through the Depression. They'd been through world wars. They lost a little sister of mine at 3 days old from spinal bifida. There were just all kinds of struggles, economic struggles and so forth, but they stayed together. So that was that rational commitment. Well, the point that I want to make is this, that while it is true in personal relationships that it's emotions that bring us together, it's also true in relationship to your organizational ministry. See, there's a very emotional part of what it is that you're doing, and you need to talk about that. I mean, there's something that still sends goosebumps down my arms whenever I hear about somebody coming to know Christ, you know, and I think, wow, that is just so great, you know, that the power of the Spirit of God that could take somebody that's just totally wretched, you know, totally godless, as we all are, you know, miserable worms, and turn them into something that is so incredibly different. And if that doesn't send goosebumps up your arms, then there's something seriously wrong with all of us, isn't there? Because God does that, and that's very emotional. Here's a statement that I oftentimes make. It's emotion that brings us together. It's rationalism that will keep us together in ministry. So what we really want to do is we want to make sure that people not only emotionally know who it is we are and what it is that we're doing, but they have this rational commitment. Now, projects tend to appeal to people's emotions. You know, you've heard of fundraising projects. Well, a fundraising project, an example of a fundraising project would be, a golf tournament. You know, I mean, people golf everywhere, you know, and that's kind of a big fundraiser, you know. Maybe they golf in most places, where I go anyway. But, you know, people golf, and they like to golf, and there's all kinds of little fundraising events that kind of center around golf tournaments. And so you kind of go to a businessman, you say, well, would you like to play in our golf tournament? He says, oh, yeah, I'd like to do that. You know, that's great. I love to golf. And I'll bring five or six of my buddies, and they'll raise some money. And so it's the motion. They didn't come because they rationally understood your mission. They didn't come because they believe in your mission or they even understand it or they even know you have one. They came because they like to play golf. But it was kind of the emotion that brought them there in the first place. And now we need to build on that opportunity. And that's a whole other conversation that we'll have a little bit later on this week. So that's an example of a project. Sometimes, you know, in a lot of the organizations with whom we work where we have a lot of students and, you know, not just in schools, but in organizations like IFES and UCCF and so forth. There are a lot of student projects, fundraising projects. They may do a serve-a-thon or some kind of an activity where, you know, basically, you know, they're working for the organization. They don't have much money. You know, that's true with, you know, students that are in the college movement. You know, they don't have any money. But they have a lot of energy, you know, so how can we capture their energy to utilize them to help us to do some of the things we need to do? And so, well, good night. Let's take a Saturday and we're going to go and we're going to just do, you know, ministry projects around, you know, the campus, around the community or whatever the case might be. So we're going to ask them to work for 6 hours. Well, let's see if we can get them to earn some money for their work. So they'll go to people. Let's say they go to 25 people and ask them for the equivalent of, say, $1 an hour. So that's $25 an hour. They work for 6 hours. That's, what, $150 if you're using my currency, and you can do the transitions. But the point is, you know, here we've done something. We've engaged them. That's good. You know, that kind of commitment is good from a developmental standpoint. They raised a little money in the process. It helps our ministry out a little bit. And, you know, it's a project. That's a fundraising project. And there are all kinds of them. There are mission-related projects. Churches do a lot of this. You know, Sue and I, my wife, a year ago or 2 years ago in October, we took a missions trip, you know, and basically it was called a Reformation tour that our pastor led. And we came across to Europe and we went over to, you know, Wartburg Castle and we went to Worms and we went to Vienna and Geneva and so forth. And we had this trip and there were like 8 couples that went on it. And it was a project. I mean, practically speaking, it generated a little money for our missions program, but at the same time, it just really brought just wonderful relationships. All those people really have become really best of friends now, and it was a good little activity. And then there are public relational projects, things that you can do public relationally. And I'm trying to think of one right now, but perhaps you can think of a couple or so. But projects are something, and the thing that distinguishes a project is that they're typically, you know, kind of one-time things. You know, we may do a golf tournament every year, but it's kind of an event that's kind of, you know, standalone event that has a beginning, it has an end, it has a purpose, And we need to define all of those things beforehand in order to really maximize their developmental value. And that's going to be a discussion that will be involved in that Wednesday strategic planning exercise. But the point is that these projects are things that we need to schedule. So we might look at our calendar and say, well, we this is a constituent group, let's say, that we really would like to develop. Students. How can we get our students involved? So maybe one time a year we plan some kind of a project that all the students can become involved in. And so we put it into the calendar. We say, okay, we're going to do this in October. We're going to do this in March. And so we do it early on so we can start promoting it. We start producing materials and say, we're going to have this great serve-a-thon, or we're going to do this great project. And it may be that we decide that there's a constituent group out there, that we really would like to engage. And so, maybe it's professional people, and how are we going to do that? So we said, well, here's a project that could work. This would be something that, these guys would be interested in, or these folks would be interested in. Projects can take on all kinds of flavors. You can bring in people to redecorate an office space, and you get volunteers to come in, or groups that will say, well, we're going to take on the responsibility for this particular room or this particular office and so forth. So people come in and do it, and that's a kind of a project. Projects are nice because they create kind of esprit de corps. You kind of get this spirit that comes out of it. In a lot of places we work, they have, senior citizens will have a bake sale. Well, frankly, that's a lot of energy to do that. And you say, well, gee, we had a bake sale and, we generated $1,000 or euros or whatever. And you say, that's just an awful lot of energy for 1,000 euros. But something? It was pretty important for those people to get together. There's some real value in doing that. They worked together. They did something together. It just, hey, this makes some sense. It was kind of fun. I like grandma's pies. She makes great pie crust, and so I'd buy one of grandma's pies before I'd buy one from the store or something like that. So it becomes, kind of a neat event. And so don't diminish the significance of projects, but kind of minimize them. I mean, I wouldn't probably do more than one or two a year, probably two a year, one in the fall, one in the spring, maybe oriented to its different groups and so forth. But I would probably think, maybe that's something that we ought to schedule. All right, then there are programs. Now, a program is differentiated from a project because it appeals rationally to people. People are making choices, and that's how I define rational. So I suppose at one level, a project has rational components because people are making a choice to participate. But now people are making a choice not to participate in a project, something that helps our organization to accomplish goals by virtue of the fact that it generates money, but now people are actually plugging into our organization by supporting something that's going to help the organization. So there is a difference. Now, for example, I give some giving programs, things that generate income, like a core donor program, a major donor program, a mega donor program, lifetime giving programs or legacy programs. Now, I wrote a book called Funding Your Vision. And Funding Your Vision, is an allegory. It just tells a story. It's kind of a simple read, but there are some profound things in it that probably are worth remembering. I'd like to think so. It's in its third printing, and it's been fairly successful. But there's a story in the book, and I think it's an interesting story because I was thinking about me when I wrote the story. But the frustrated man, there are two primary people in the book. There's the frustrated man, kind of like us, right? The frustrated person. And then there's the visionary. The visionary is the kind of the person that's got it all figured out. He's done it before and so forth. And so these people are kind of interacting all throughout the book, the frustrated man and the visionary. Well, there comes a point in time when the frustrated man comes to the visionary's office and the visionary says, hey, come here. And he directs him to his desk, and it happens to be a roll-top desk. You know what I mean by a roll-top desk? That's familiar. I don't know if we have just roll-top desks are unique to America or what, but it has a lot of little cubby holes in it, places where you can put things. And he looks at the frustrated man. He says, "You know why people like roll-top desks?" Well, this guy's sitting there probably saying, "Oh, I don't get the foggiest idea why people like roll-top desks." He says, "People like roll-top desks because they like cubby holes." And that's an important point. They like cubbyholes. We are all creatures that have some level of organizational need. I, for years, collected every single boarding pass that I ever received getting on an airplane. I don't know why. I mean, I just did it. And, you know, I'd put them in my pocket, and I'd come home. It was back when they had cardboard ones. Now they have these electronic tickets, you know, and so it's I don't do it anymore. But I would take, and then I'd come home, and I'd take them, and I'd stuff them in a cubbyhole. And, you know, at the end of the year, I'd kind of wrap them all up with a rubber band and write on the side of them, you know, 1998 or something, and I'd throw them in the closet. I've got piles of these things. You know, but I like cubbyholes. People like cubbyholes. And so it's one thing, for example, to ask a donor to give you a gift. And so you say, well, gee, you know, we need money at our organization. Would you like to give us a gift? He says, yeah. So he writes you a check. First of all, you should never ask anybody for a gift. That's kind of a developmental principle. If you want them to give you $25, then ask them for $25. Don't ask them for a gift. That's one of the biggest mistakes we make in development. But let me put it this way. Let's say that you have we'll call it a major donor program. And a major donor program, remember, a major donor is $1,000 or more. And so let's call our major donor program something. Let's call it the Cornerstone 100. Okay, we're looking for 100 people who would give us, and let's call a major gift, let's call it $500, or what would be the equivalent in your currency of $500 US. So we're looking for 100 people that would give $500 a year. And we'd like you to consider being one of those 100. Now, notice what I've done. You know, I mean, I might ask you for a gift, and you might write me a check for $500. But I'm saying, I'd like you to be one of 100. You're saying, well, golly, you know, I could do that. And there's this sense that we all have of wanting to be a part of something. You know, why do kids, when they come to college, join fraternities? Because they want to be a part of something. And why do people, you know, a lot of people go to church because they want to be a part of a community. They join service clubs. They do all kinds of things because there's this inherent desire, this need that we all have to belong to something. Well, I'm going to be one of 100. And now you're saying, well, and you may want to publish the names of the 100 people that are part of this foundational group, this cornerstone society or whatever you might want to call it. And that's what I mean by a program. And I think you ought to have programs, you know, for core donors. A lot of organizations in our country call their core donor programs something like Circle of Friends. We're looking for, you know, 2,500 circle, you know, friends in our circle, you know, people that kind of lock arms with us financially by giving us contributions of even $1 a week. Well, $1 a week, $60 a year. If you have enough people doing that, that represents, you know, a sizable, you know, contribution to your financial need, to meeting your annual financial needs. So that's what I mean by a giving program. But there are non-giving programs as well that have equal significance in terms of their developmental value. They just have, you know, significance in a different way. Because remember, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get people to make choices as it relates to our organization. Because a choice, you know, yes or no, is still a rational answer, isn't it? You know, will you marry me? No. Okay. What does that they say? I mean, that's a choice. I'm saying, no, I won't marry you. Will you give to me? Yes or no. And so yes, you know, yeses are good in terms of building developmental infrastructure. Noes are not good. All right. So what you want to do is you want people to say yes to you. Well, what you need to do is you need to provide them what I think are a variety of ways in which to say yes. You see, if you're asking them to give to you and that's the only option that you give, will you become a member of our core donor program? No. Okay, what do you do now? I guess you just kind of walk away, don't you? But what you really want to communicate to constituents is that there are all kinds of ways that you could be a part of our organization. So let me just share with you four or five ways that you could be a part of our organization. Now you're talking to them. You know, maybe you'd like to be one of our prayer partners. We're just asking the Lord for 5,000 prayer partners all around the nation, you know, all around the city, all around the community, whatever. And maybe you'd like to be one of our prayer partners. We'd like to send you a 30-day prayer guide. You know, maybe you'd like to be a sponsor of one of our students. You know, at UCCF, it costs us. Well, I wouldn't even talk about money. Let's just put it another way. You know, maybe you'd like to be a sponsor of one of our students that are in one of our chapters. And here's what that means. It means, you know, would you be willing to, you know, send them birthday cards and Christmas cards, and, you know, and you know, you may have some other little things that you might ask them, that would you be willing to pray for them on a regular basis? Would you like to be a sponsor of one of our members, our medical team members? And you'll get their name, and we'd encourage you to write them and just, you know, let them know you're praying for them and be a part of their lives. Well, that would be wonderful. You know, it didn't cost any money to do that, but it's something that you could do, something that you could say yes to. And so, you know, we have support auxiliaries. Maybe you've got a bunch of senior citizens in the community where you serve, and, you know, you start a seniors auxiliary. And what's the seniors auxiliary do? Well, maybe they serve as hosts and hostesses for activities that might be taking place in conjunction with your ministry. And you give them other assignments, things that they could do, because they want to participate. And again, asking for volunteers is one thing. Asking someone to commit to an auxiliary is quite another, because they're making a commitment to something other than just being a volunteer, some kind of a volunteer exercise. So programs need to be scheduled. And so that you might say, well, you know, in the fall of 2005, we're going to launch our major donor program. And we're going to have a special emphasis between October 1st and October 31st to introduce, you know, the new major donor program to our constituents. And we're going to strategize how we're going to do that. And so it becomes a part of the calendar. Okay, so we're going to book it. In the same way with, you know, we're going to start a sponsorship program. So we're going to do that at a certain time, because, and then you put it into the calendar. And what I like about calendars, and what I encourage you to do, if you have a Microsoft as a suite, and I'm sure all the other suites that are available, you know, computer suites or word processing that include typically a spreadsheet program and a, you know, communications program and so forth, database program. In Microsoft, you know, Outlook, if you have Outlook, which is a part of the Microsoft suite, you can print out like blank calendars, which are really nice to do. And what I like to do is I like to lay them out all on a sheet of paper, you know, put them on a table. And when I'm doing the organizational calendar for the year, I want to see everything. I'm just kind of a real visual person. But if I see a lot of things clumped up in one month, I'm going to try to shift them around, because I realize that in order for me to effectively do a good job, I'm going to have to and to orchestrate the resources that are going to be required, specifically personnel resources, in order to get things done. I'm going to have to, you know, make sure that things are spread out a little bit. Okay, activities are another thing that we do. Now, activities are distinguished by the fact that they happen on an annual basis. There are some things that you may do every year. Special programs, you know, surrounding holiday events. Maybe your organization sponsors a candlelight service at Christmas, and that's something that you just do, and everybody knows that it happens on, you know, the two Saturdays before Christmas, where you really try to bring a lot of people together. And it's a very important event. It's something that your organization may be known for. And if you haven't got those kinds of activities, then try to think about some, because you ought to have things that activities that people automatically relate to your organization. And so, you know, that the annual candlelight service is held by UCCF chapter, and it's done on every campus, you know, on the second Saturday of December. And, you know, it becomes kind of a tradition. People look forward to that. And you really promote it among the communities that, you know, that you serve. And it's just kind of one of those real special events. Now, planning that event so that it has real developmental impact is another whole discussion. And that's not something that we are going to get in particularly here. But I think we will address that issue, at least in a tangential kind of way in our session on Wednesday. But those things are really important. So schedule those activities. I mean, there are undoubtedly things that you are doing on a regular basis. Maybe you have an annual Bible conference, you know, or spiritual life conference. You know, those are kind of activities. They just happen every year. And if you don't have them, then come up with something that, you know, could be forever, you know, attached to your organization. And so that people know that this particular activity is sponsored by the medical group or whatever the case might be. Banquets can be annual activities, special dinners and receptions, scheduled concerts and drama activities and things of that nature. You know, a lot of the organizations in our country have, you know, fairs and carnivals and things of that nature. I'm not sure that I'm real excited about those, but, you know, because I think they're probably is not as good a developmental activity as some could be, but nonetheless, you know, they've craft fairs are really important, and a lot of churches do those as outreach ministries. Our church, when we were in Colorado, we used to live in the state of Colorado, which is in the mountains. Most of you, you know, are aware of that. And, but, you know, we'd have a mountain Christmas fair, you know, and every Saturday, you know, the last Saturday and right after Thanksgiving, you know, there'd be this huge fair. And it was kind of a craft fair. And, you know, people would buy Christmas presents and so forth. It was a huge event. I mean, like thousands of people came. But it was a wonderful event because they all came to our church. And so we had greeters out there that just welcomed to our church, you know, and they just, and a lot of people that used to come to that craft fair, that was their first exposure to our ministry. You know, they'd end up coming to our church because it was the first church that they ever came to that somebody was kind to them. You know, they didn't feel like an intruder, but they really were welcomed and so forth. So that would be the example of an activity, something that happened annually. All right, and then the last thing that we schedule is an event. Now, events are only, they're different from activities in that they don't happen every year. So there are certain things that, you know, don't happen every year, like a special anniversary, like the 25th anniversary or the 50th anniversary. Those are really special events, aren't they? I mean, if your parents were married for 50 years, as mine were, and, you know, we're getting ready to celebrate their 70th, you know, but, you know, that's a pretty special event. So we brought out their 50th anniversary, you know, we had a big special deal. It's like my dad had an 80th birthday party, and that was just kind of a big deal. He just had his 90th last year, and we had a big deal about that, too. And so those are special events. And so I would suggest, this is just kind of a, for whatever it's worth, idea, but I would suggest that you celebrate anniversaries, and I would celebrate them every 5 years. And so celebrate your 5th, your 10th, your 15th, your 20th anniversary. And so if you've got an anniversary coming up for your organization, you know, do something special. And there's a reason for that. I think there are all kinds of reasons for it. Number one, it gives you an excuse to kind of tout who it is you are and what it is you've been doing all these years. Number two, anniversaries kind of enhance your credibility rating with people. You know, that you've been around for this long. Well, that says something. It's kind of like, as we were saying yesterday, if you go down into London and you go past the haberdasher that, you know, up there on the, you know, the mantle of the, or lintel of the doorpost, you see this, you know, since 1542. Gosh, this guy's been making hats since 1542. I mean, good night, they're pretty credible. Having a hat from there means something. But the point is that is an important point. The older you get, the more credible you become. I thought it was great getting older, you know. I couldn't wait for gray hair to come in. It came in a little bit late in my life, and I was really aggravated by that because I figured that, you know, the older you get, you know, the more gray hair you have, the more credibility you have. So celebrate those kinds of activities. But every, you know, 5 years, and so that's probably, certainly within 5 years of now, you're going to have an anniversary. And maybe it's your 13th year, right? It gives you 2 years to plan for it. But make it a big event, big celebration event. And it gives you an opportunity to share what it is that God's done, the people that have been impacted, the lives that have been changed, and so forth. And, you know, some people don't even know that your organization exists, to say nothing about the fact that it's been around for 25 years or 50 years or whatever the case might be. So it gives you an opportunity to do some things. So those are the kinds of things that you would include in a calendar. So the first thing that I would do is, you know, remember, we're talking about mission-related activities that we're going to plan, all right? So we're going to think about that. That's going to be things like, you know, Pod's going to put, you know, the you know, this is when, you know, this newsletter is going to go out, and this is when this newsletter is going to go out, and he's going to plan what's going to go in and so forth. So you got that planned out for a year. And then we're going to put, you know, development-related activities, because we are all involved in development, so we're going to do this, that, and the other thing. We're going to launch certain things so they now show up in the calendar. When you go through the process, creating the calendar, which is carries us over from page 2 to 3, notice that every one of those things ought to have goals attached to it. In other words, what are we really trying to accomplish? And this goes back a little bit to our early discussion. What are we trying to accomplish in terms of our ministry this year? And how are these activities, or how can these activities enable us to do that? So if you look at your ministry goals and your developmental goals and some personal goals that you might have, and if you kind of, you know, begin to articulate those, and the articulation, the quantification of goals and objectives is very, very important. That's why I always love the grace activity, you know, well, what are you going to do this year that's going to contribute to the fulfillment of the mission statement? Because, you know, the assumption could be made that everybody knows that anyway. And, you know, that's just not true. There's a statement that I've made, and I don't know if I made it yesterday, but I make this statement a lot, so if you'll excuse me if you've heard it before, because you'll hear it again, I can promise you, if you sit in another Jerry Twombly session. But there are two assumptions that we make in ministry, and both of these assumptions are wrong. It's very, very important that you know this. One assumption that we make in ministry that's wrong is that when we say something, everybody got it, that they just really understood it. That's a wrong assumption. I say if you believe that's true, that if you say something, everybody got it, you've never had a teenager live in your house. You just never had that happen. Because the realities are they don't get it. I mean, my kids would do something and I'd look at them and I said, if I've told you once, you've heard it, haven't you? I told you 1,000 times. And they're saying, well, gee, Dad, I don't remember that. And you say, where were you? The other assumption that we make that is wrong is that people, you know, even if they do get what it is that we're saying, because we're constantly, communicating messages about our organization, you can't assume that they can figure out or they're going to expend the energy to try to figure out how to deal with it. In other words, you can talk about the medical association, and I'm listening to Chris, and he's just, waxing eloquent, and I'm thinking, oh, this is great. And so Chris is kind of watching me, and I'm kind of really tracking with him. And so he's assuming, well, Jerry got it. Now, you can't assume that I'm sitting there saying, well, I bet you they need money. I bet you they could use $500. So maybe I'll just write a check for Chris for $500. I bet you they could use prayer. I bet you they could use referrals because I know, four or five Christian doctors that I know don't even know about this organization. I bet you they could use this, that, or the other thing. And you can't assume that. You cannot assume that I am going to make those connections. I have developed an incredible amount of sales resistance, over the last several years, and I don't get anything. I don't take any, unless I'm really lazy, as we all are, in dealing with information. So what Chris needs to tell me, he says, let me share with you 5 or 6 ways that you could be a part of what it is that we're doing. He says, you could, be a part of our Cornerstone 100, you could consider a contribution of $500 a year to help us to do this because this needs to be funded. You could pray for us. And you just tell, you're telling them what it is that they ought to be thinking about. So write down your goals and quantify them. I mean, literally, I would really encourage you to sit down here and say, as mundane as this may seem, what are my ministry goals? And you write them down specifically. And then go back and look at your calendar and say, well, how can what it is that these goals that we want to accomplish, our developmental goals is we want to increase our database by 100 this year. That's a quantifiable goal. Well, then go back here and say, well, how are we going to do it? Because people who participate in projects might be, people that would want to be added to your database. And so, if these aren't connected, then this is fruitless, and every page in this is fruitless because it's all driven by this. What it is that we need to accomplish from a developmental standpoint. Then list the projects and programs, activities and events, and along each side of them, you may want to identify specific goals that you want to accomplish with that particular event. We're going to, this event, we want to add 20 new names to our database. All right, then write it down. So everything has a purpose. It's not an end in itself. Projects, programs, activities, events, newsletters, brochures, nothing stands alone in the development office. Nothing. It all contributes to the fulfillment of the mission to which we've committed ourselves. Then assess yourself and put the schedule in and organize it. That's a whole other discussion. I'm going to talk about organization, I think, tomorrow. How do you organize yourself to get all this stuff done? And that's a whole other topic. And if you haven't heard my presentation on organization, you really need to be here. Because and check to make sure it's tomorrow. I think it's tomorrow. But the point is that I can convince you, before you leave here, I can convince you that there's not a thing that I've just talked about today, which sounds a little bit overwhelming when you try to put it all together and try to figure out, well, how are we going to get all this done? Because did you know Jerry? Maybe you didn't know this Jerry. I'm a volunteer. I have another job. Chris has got another job. So how in the world do you expect me to do this? Come on, get a life, man. I've got one. Yeah, I've heard all that before, you know, and so I'm used to it. But the point is that I can show you how you can get all this done and never have to build relationships with maybe four or five people, maybe even two or three. Yeah, I mean, I'll convince you of that. And it's because it's really a very, very solid organizational model. Time's up, and now we're going to get our instructions as to what we do. Thanks for we didn't allow much time for discussion on that, but I'm not known for allowing a lot of time for discussion.